Today is Sunday morning at Shari Tefillah. It's the 6th of December, and we are learning Mishnah with passages of Talmud, as we know. Masechet Rosh Hashanah. We're in Perek Shlishi, the third Perek, and we last time began Mishnah Zayin, the seventh Mishnah, which is the second to last Mishnah of the chapter.
Yeah.
We actually not only began it, we even finished it, but only superficially. So let's read it again. Mishnah Zayin, which is in the printing of the Mishnah we have, it's on page 319, the Albeck edition. And what we read is as follows, Mishnah Zayin. Four lines from the bottom of the main text on the page. Hatokea latoch habor, or latoch hadut, or latoch hapitas. Hatokea, right, that is the blower, the one who blows, and of course we took the shofar. Latoch habor, inside of the pit, o latoch hadut, or inside of a basement, o latoch hapitas, or inside of a pitas. A pitas is a very, very large cheres, a ceramic bowl that you can actually get inside of. It's that big.
What was it used for?
I don't know, but I can guess it's used for storing grain. Right? That's what I imagine.
Not a cistern, not for water.
Not for water, no.
That has its own term. I think we've
Well,
over that.
The term for a cistern is a bore. That's mentioned here, bor, that's the pit. In kol shofar shama yatsa. Vim kol havara shama lo yatsa. If the sound of shofar he heard, yatsa.
Yeah.
And if the sound of echo he heard, lo yatsa. Right? We did that last time. V'chein mi shaya over achorei beit ha-kneset, o shaya beito samuch le-beit ha-kneset, v'shama kol shofar o kol megillah, etc. Let's just translate that. And so, right, v'chein mi shaya over achorei beit ha-kneset. And so, means someone, shaya over, that was walking, was traveling, was passing, Achorei Beit HaKnesset, behind the Beit HaKnesset, O Shaya Samukh Le Beit HaKnesset, O Beito Samukh Le Beit HaKnesset, or his house was near Samukh, right, near
the
Beit
HaKnesset,
right?
From
right?
The Beit Medrash, yeah.
Right. The Shema Kol Shofar Kol Megillah, and heard the sound of the Shofar or the sound of the Megillah of Esther and Purim. Im Kivein Libo Yatsa, if he focused his heart, yatsa. Next page, bimlav lo yatsa. And if not, he didn't fulfill the mitzvah. Afal pi, I'm at the top of the next page, page 320. Afal pi shezeh shema vezeh shema. Even though this one heard and this one heard, zeh kivein libo vezeh lo kivein libo. And this one didn't focus his heart.
Right.
So let's go back a little bit and just understand what we're talking about. So the Mishnah seems to have two parts, right? The first is about someone who hears the shofar being blown in a space which is an echo. And the question is, what did you hear? Right? If you heard the shofar itself, that's fine. If you heard the echo, then it's not fine. Then it's not good. You didn't fulfill the mitzvah. Which means that there are certain cases which you hear a shofar, you didn't fulfill the mitzvah because you didn't really hear a shofar. You heard a shofar once removed. The second part of the Mishnah is also about different levels of hearing, but in a different sense. Not because the thing itself that you heard is once removed, but because your psychological mechanism on some level wasn't attuned to what you're hearing.
Yeah.
But in both cases, the common denominator is that there are hearings that sound the same, but one of them fulfills the mitzvah, one different. In one case, it's because of the quality of the sound itself. The other side of the coin is the quality of the psychological attunement to the sound. And in saying this, what I'm trying to do is explain one word in the Mishnah. the second to last word of the third line in the page. V'chein. V'chein. And so, that word connects between the two parts of the Mishnah, as if to indicate that there's some connection between them. What's the connection between the matter of hearing an echo and the matter of not focusing, not having kavanah? So I'm trying to explain. The connection is, in both cases, it's a sound that is identical, but in one case you fulfill the mitzvah, one case not. That's the difference. It looks from the outside to be identical, but in an inner sense it's different, in one case because of the quality of the sound itself, and the other case because of the quality of the attunement of the heart. Exactly. Okay. So now let's go through the questions that I prepared. Some of which we talked about last time. Mishnah 7. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Why do you think that someone would tokea letoch habor? I guess I have to give you a Mishnah there, right?
Yeah, 19 and 20 might be
right. Right. So the first question says...
It's on the questions, but here's the Mishnah.
Why would someone do such a thing as blowing into a basement or a pit or a very, very big ceramic jar? And you remember from last week what we talked about? Why you would do such a thing?
Because the people, the enemies would be around.
Yeah, like Rav Chai Gaon, one of the Gaonim in the area of Iraq, in I think it's the 8th or 9th centuries, says that that's what we're talking about. This might be in the period of the Hadrianic persecutions. We're talking about the year 130 to 135 of the Common Era, perhaps, when Judaism was outlawed on lots of different levels by the Emperor Hadrian. Okay? Or sometime later, other persecutions.
These are Greeks? Don't the Greeks do?
That's going back that far. You think of Hanukkah.
Oh,
that.
Wait a minute.
The Greeks, the Romans entered Jerusalem about 40 years before the Common Era. Mm-hmm. About 40 years before the Common Era.
Could it have to do with the hype from the Greeks as well?
Don't know.
You know, it could have been possible. I mean, because in other words...
Could be possible.
Historically, these things
right?
are... Yeah, there were...
Greeks were big, studying Torah, didn't they?
Yeah, it could be.
Or maybe they didn't have... Maybe they didn't... I don't know. Did they study Torah back then?
Mm-hmm. It could be. We don't have too many historical records from going from that far back. The records we have are in the books of the Maccabim, the Maccabean books. And there's no mention there specifically of shofar. There's mention of the fact in the book of the Maccabim that they couldn't fulfill the mitzvah of sukkah. I don't know about the shofar.
So the shofar could be blown on Rosh Hashanah. You always blew it on Rosh Hashanah.
Uh-huh.
For me, it's just something. Well, maybe it's a little bit off the top, tiny bit maybe. So back then, when did they? Talking about studying Torah.
So you know what? I'm going to go on. This is only an introduction to what you really want to focus on, which is Mishnah Chet, the 8th Mishnah. Not that this is unimportant. Mishnah 7, we're in question 2. From the phrase Kavanat Alev, what can we infer about the metaphorical usage of the word Lev? Like Kavanah in the Torah, I should say Torah Shabbat Peh, is called Kavanat Alev, that's the full expression. And I'm asking, what does it actually mean? It means focusing, right? Focusing. Would we call it focusing of the heart? Or would we call it focusing of the mind? Right? We talked about that last week also. It would seem from here that the word Lev doesn't just mean what we would call Lev, doesn't mean just simply heart and emotions, right? It means some type of intellectual awareness, some type of focus.
Deep concentration.
We think
heart,
of in the...
Take it to heart. It
depends on what culture
more than
you're in.
Yeah, it's certainly... That's really true, right? these metaphors are culturally bound. When you say take it to heart, well, what does that mean? Sometimes we mean something emotional, sometimes we mean something intellectual. That's a really good part.
Yeah.
But here it's certainly more intellectual. Here it's more the brain than is any type of being in love with the shofar.
You have to think about the brain.
Yeah. This is not Cupid. Okay, number three. What type of kavanah does it look like the Mishnah is referring to? So what exactly does it mean that if you were walking behind the Beit Knesset, or you lived there, and you heard the shofar, you heard the Megillah, if you had kavanah, yatsah, if you didn't have kavanah, lo yatsah, what does exactly mean? What type of intellectual focus is it? Anyone want to suggest? There's at least two possibilities, if not 10 possibilities.
That means to believe in it, to believe in that with your heart.
Believe in it.
To believe in the shofar, in Rosh Hashanah, like this, in the holiness of the day.
To believe in it. What does it mean to believe in it?
Believe it with your mind. You're concentrating your mind on it.
So a slightly different way to say, maybe the idea would be, if you are focusing on the mitzvah, that you are conscious of
focusing on the mitzvah.
So as it's happening, you're conscious of that's what's happening.
That it's
you're conscious, you know exactly what it is for.
That it's a mitzvah.
You intend to be fulfilling a mitzvah.
Right, that you intend to be doing a mitzvah. Yeah. That's one possibility. Right. There's other possibilities.
The passing of the synagogue brings to mind a casual occurrence. So you may be passing by, but you stop. You're aware of what's going on. You're part of the mitzvah, as you say.
So you're agreeing with David.
Yeah.
As I might have been just walking my dog, and I didn't even remember it's Rosh Hashanah, but I hear the shofar say, it's Rosh Hashanah. I'd like to fulfill the mitzvah.
Stop and listen.
Stop and listen.
Yeah.
Any other possibilities?
It could just mean, that's a shofar. I realize that I'm hearing a shofar, but I'm not thinking about the mitzvah.
Right. It looks like you've learned this already, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard this before.
Right.
So is that, you don't know, what is that? Is that somebody blowing their horn?
Yeah.
Of their car horn?
Right, is it a fast day?
Is it a fast day?
Right, they blew the shofar on a fast day. Did they blow the shofar on a fast day, right?
Right.
So those are the two possibilities, the two major possibilities, that the baseline is I didn't know it's a shofar blast. If I had kavanah that it's a shofar blast, then I fulfill, even though I might not have had kavanah to do the mitzvah.
To know what it means.
And the other level is, I knew it was Rosh Hashanah, and I knew that this blast is a shofar, but if I had kavanah that it would be a mitzvah for me, then I fulfilled the mitzvah. And if not, then not. Those are the two possibilities, and we'll see them in the Gemara right here.
Well, I have a question. With the latter, you'd have to be an ignoramus to not know all that's a shofar. If you were, I mean, what would be the possibility of I don't know what that is? And if you don't know what it is, then why are you fulfilling?
The Gemara suggests it sounds like a donkey braying.
Oh, okay. So maybe in that dang time when people were used to hearing donkeys,
that was a common sound.
Okay.
Or you can say to yourself, I mean, have we ever been walking down the street talking to somebody or thinking about something, and there is a sound which you hear, but you're not even full, you don't
fully hear it.
You're not aware of your mind that you
could have heard anything.
Did you just hear that horn?
Right.
Oh yeah, I did. I wasn't focused on it, but yeah, now that you've said that, I
that's
was.
A shofar, okay.
That's how you can not hear it and know that it's a shofar.
Okay.
The circumstance doesn't seem practical, but so often in the Mishnah, things are not practical. Right.
Doesn't it seem practical?
Rosh Hashanah. So
everybody
knows.
Out to go to the bathroom.
But unless things have really changed, then the highlight of Rosh Hashanah is the sound of the shofar. It's a major mitzvah.
Well, I think that Paul and Ben are correct in that one of these two interpretations is much, much more likely than the other. It seems to be that you would probably know instinctively, intuitively, that is a shofar sound, and the question of the kavanah is, did you have kavanah to do the mitzvah not? Which would mean that this Mishnah is a proof for the fact that you have to have kavanah to mitzvah to fulfill the mitzvah. And indeed, that's what the Gemara says, that this is a proof that you need kavanah to fill the mitzvah, to fill the mitzvah. But then the Gemara will answer, no, you could interpret it differently. You could interpret the other way, but the other way does seem to be much less likely. So let's see the Gemara. It's the second passage I brought from the Gemara, which is in C, on the question sheet. And it says the following. It says, well, actually, I made a mistake. It's in D. I put it, it's a D there. There shouldn't be a D there. It just should be a C. That's my computer program. Kesavar Rava. Mitzvot ein srichot kavana. So it means, thought Rava that mitzvot ein srichot kavana, that mitzvot don't require kavana, and don't require kavana means don't require kavana that I mean to do the mitzvah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That rather, even if I do the act, even without intention, that will be a mitzvah act, I still fulfill the mitzvah.
Even if you don't think about it.
Right. That's what Rava said. But then the Gemara says, eteve, which means we bring an objection. Hayah kore b'torah v'giyazman ha-mikra. This is a Mishnah we all know from the beginning of Tractate Brachot, because we learned it together. It says, if he was reading the Torah, and arrived the time of mikra, the time of mikra means the time of Kriyat Shema. I just happened to be reading the Torah, and I happened to be reading the passages that are the passages of Kriyat Shema, and the time for Kriyat Shema arrived. Says the Mishnah, I'm sorry, says the Gemara, Im kivein libo yatsa, vim lav lo yatsa. So the Gemara here is bringing that Mishnah in Tractate Brachot that says, Im kivein libo yatsa, and if not, lo yatsa. So you see from that, you need the Kavanah. You were reading in the Torah, you knew what you were doing, but you didn't necessarily have intention that this reading would be a fulfilling of the Mitzvah of Shema. If you had intention to do so, then you fulfilled. Yeah. And that proved that mitzvot require Kavanah. The doing of the act itself of reading is not enough. You have to intend that it is to be doing the Mitzvah. And then the Gemara says, my love, what isn't it? In other words, isn't it that this Mishnah is talking about intention to do the mitzvah of Shema? I read the whole sentence. It's beginning from the second word of the second line. My love, kivin, libo, yet, let's say, isn't it that he intended his heart to fulfill? Isn't that what it means? Isn't that the simple meaning of the Mishnah? Which proves that mitzvot tzrichot kavana. And the Gemara says, no, lo. Likrot. To read. All it means is that you have had intention to read. You didn't need intention to do the mitzvah. And as long as you had intention to read, then you fill the mitzvah. But then the Gemara says, Likrot hakakari. To read, but he was reading. It says he was reading. Then you say if he had intention to read, but he was reading.
I didn't have intention.
How can you read without having intention?
Yeah. And the answer is, Bekore lahagia. He was reading to proofread. In other words, if he was reading to proofread, he wasn't really reading. And then it says, if he kivein libo, if he had intention, it could mean if he had intention to read, even not knowing that it's Shema time, even not intending to do Shema, as long as he had intention to read, then he fulfilled the mitzvah. So clearly here, at this point in the Gemara, it seems like this Mishnah in Tractate Brachot does prove that mitzvot tzrichot kavanah. That mitzvot require kavanah. But we have a dochak, we have a very, very forced way of reading the Mishnah, so that won't prove that mitzvot tzrichot kavanah. But it does seem that the pshat is that he was reading. Of course he was reading.
What did you say dochak is?
Dochak means forced.
Meaning what?
Meaning that...
exaggerated. Is that what you mean?
Improbable. Improbable. In other words, it's most probable that this Mishnah and Brachot does prove that mitzvot require kavanah to do the mitzvah, but we have a force, we have an improbable way of reading the Mishnah that will help us to avoid the conclusion that mitzvot tzrichot kavanah. Now, you always have to know in this type of Gemara, the Gemara knows as well as we do that this interpretation is forced. It's not pulling the wool over its eyes, but it's trying to show that it is possible, if you want to hold a different opinion, you can wiggle out of it. Tashma. It's about six words from the end of the line. Tashma coming. In other words, a second proof. We're going to bring another proof that mitzvot tzrichot kavanah, and let's see if you can wiggle out of this one. Tashma. Haya over achorei beit hakneset. Oh, Shaya Beito Samuch LeBeita Knesset. Recognize that? V'shama kol shofar o kol megillah im kiven libo yatsa v'im lav lo yatsa. That's our Mishnah. And it proves that mitzvot require kavanah. It says if you had kavanah yatsa, if you didn't know, it proves mitzvot require kavanah. Let's say, kavanah to do the mitzvah. But then, and then the Gemara proves its point by saying, my love, what isn't this? In kivein libo letzet? Isn't it, if he had intention, letzet, had intention to do the mitzvah, to fulfill, isn't that what it's talking about? Obviously it is. But then the Gemara says, no, we can wiggle out of that one also and say, lo, lishmoa. No, it's only kavanah lishmoa, it's only kavanah to hear. It's only kavanah, you didn't need hakavanah letzet, hakavanah lehir. But then the Gemara says, lishmoa hashama, what do you mean? To hear. But he heard, of course he heard. Who else was, he heard it, he was there. How can you say, if he heard it, if he had kavanah to hear, then he fulfills. But he did hear it anyway. So then the Gemara says what David said. Savar hamor ba'almahu. He thought it was a mere donkey. He wasn't paying attention. He didn't hear the sound too well. And if you had asked him 5 seconds later, did you hear a shofar? A donkey was, a shofar. But when he heard it, he didn't know it was a shofar. But if he had kavanah, that is a shofar, then fulfill the obligation. So again, we're interpreting our Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah in the same way we interpreted the Mishnah in Brachot, that it does seem to mean that it's kavanah letzet, and it proves mitzvot tzrichot kavanah, but you can, if you really want, you can avoid the obvious conclusion by understanding the Mishnah in a forced fashion.
Is it of significance that this forced reading is not attributed to somebody? In other words, nobody's really asserting that, I guess. It's just, or are they?
Well, remember, it began, the first four words of the passage that holds rava mitzvot don't require kavanah.
Yeah.
And we're bringing this Mishnah to prove him wrong. Uh-huh. And the editor is saying, no, he could get out of it by saying the following. Eteve, another proof that mitzvot require kavanah. Nitkaven shomei, and this is a braita we're reading now, this is a braita. Nitkaven shomei avalo nitkaven mashmiya. Mashmiya avalo nitkaven shomeya lo yatsa. Ad shitkaven shomei o mashmiya. End of braita. Translation of the braita. Nitkaven shomei avalo nitkaven mashmiya. Had intention, the listener and not the, there's no word in English.
Trumpeter.
And not the trumpeter. Okay. And not the trumpeter. Or, mashmiya v'lonit keven shomea. Oh, the trumpeter had intention and not the hearer. Lo yatsa. Ad shit keven shomea mashmiya. Unless had intention both the shomea and the mashmiya, the one who hears the sound and the one who makes the sound. That's what a braita says. And now the Gemara explains why this is a proof that mitzvot require kavanah. Bishlama, it makes sense. Nitkaven mashmiya v'lo nitkaven shomea. It makes sense when you're looking at the part of the Mishnah that says had intention the trumpeter and didn't have intention the hearer. Kasava chamur balmahu, that he thought it was a mere donkey sound. In other words, when you talk about the kavanah of the shomei, of the hearer, you can get out of the intention that's the kavanah to do the mitzvah by saying he just heard a donkey thought, and he has to have a kavanah that it's a shofar. But you can't wiggle out of it with the other part of the Mishnah that says, Ela, the fourth word of the second to last line, Ela nitkaven shomei v'lo nitkaven mashmiya heichi mishkachat la. Rather, the part of the Mishnah that says had kavanah the shomea but didn't have kavanah the mashmiya, didn't have kavanah the trumpeter, heichi mishkachat la. How can you find it? How can you find a way to interpret it that will still let Rava off the hook? It will still let Rava say that mitzvot require kavanah, because can you say that someone was blowing a trumpet and didn't know he was blowing a trumpet? And unless he had kavanah to blow a trumpet, he can't help you fill the mitzvah. That's impossible. To blow a trumpet without knowing you're blowing a trumpet? Shofar. Blow a shofar without knowing you're blowing a shofar. So that proves, therefore, that the kavana is that you're blowing a shofar. You know blowing it, but you have to have intention to do the mitzvah. But the Gemara has a way of getting out of this one also. And it says, lo, no.
But the kaya l'shir.
Bitokeya l'shir.
For a melody, for a song.
Right. I'm sorry, I read it wrong. Hechimish kachadla, lav bitokeya l'shir. How do we find it? How do we interpret the, yeah, this case? Isn't it that he's blowing to for song? In other words, isn't it a case in which someone was blowing the shofar to make nice music? And if he had intention that it's for the shofar mitzvah, he fulfilled it. If not, then he didn't. That Gemara is saying, I said it wrong. That's the only way to understand it, that someone was blowing the shofar, but not necessarily for the mitzvah, but rather lashir. And then if he had intention for shofar, then that's shofar. If he didn't have intention for shofar mitzvah, then not. Right? But the Gemara wiggles out of it by saying, Dilma dekan minvach nevuche. Perhaps he was, literally means perhaps he was barking like a dog.
Just blowing. Okay.
Which means perhaps he was cleaning out the shofar and he blew into it to get the spittle out and it happened to make a noise. That he didn't even intend to make a noise. And then you can interpret the Mishnah saying, if he intended to make a noise, if fill the mitzvah, if he didn't intend to make a noise, then not. But you don't need kavanah to do the mitzvah. So that means that in the end conclusion, we say that all of these three sources probably prove that mitzvot require kavanah to do the mitzvah, but in all three sources you can find a way, unlikely as it may be, like dohak, dachuk as it may be, that you don't have to come to the conclusion that mitzvot require kavanah letzet. All they require is kavanah to do the action. That's it. That's the Gemara. Yeah. Let's go to question 4 on the sheet.
The questions?
Yeah. Question 4.
Question
In
4.
What sense is Megillah fundamentally different than shofar, such that we could have thought that the requirement of kavanah applies to shofar but would not necessarily apply to Megillah? So first, let's just think out of this context, the mitzvah of Megillah versus the mitzvah of shofar. And the most basic technical level is a big difference between them. The most basic difference, a technical difference between Megillah and shofar. Night and day.
I think Megillah, you're required to hear it, and you're required to say it. Read it, by my recollection, and the shofar, you're required to hear it.
Okay, so that's not true, because we don't read the Megillah, we hear it.
That's our agent.
The same thing with shofar. Now, there is a machloket, really, concerning shofar, if the fundamental mitzvah is to hear or to blow. But there's something more basic. This is the right to the Rabbanan,
yeah.
Right? Comparing apples and oranges, the right to the Rabbanan. And we know that Doraita has, of course, stricter requirements than the Rabbanan. You could have said that mitzvot srechot kavanah, that's Doraita. But the Rabbanan did.
When you have a shofar, you have to hear, but you don't have to understand. So when you have words.
I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about the most technical thing, that this one comes from the Torah, it's divine, this one comes from the rabbis. But that's all?
Yeah.
And you could have said that the requirements of shofar don't spill over to mitzvot the Rabbanan.
Right.
But the point is that that distinction is not made by Rav Mishnah. Not made. And here you have a principle that goes like this. Kol de tikkun Rabbanan mi'ein d'oraita tikkun. All that decreed the rabbis, they decreed it like the Rabbanan. Like the Raita. That is, mitzvot the Rabbanan are according to the paradigms of mitzvot the Raita. And in many cases we find that the same stringencies of the Raita apply to the Rabbanan. Give you an example, famous example that's often discussed during Hanukkah. Women are exempt from positive time-bound mitzvot deraita. They're also exempt from positive time-bound mitzvot derabanan. The rabbis instituted the mitzvot derabanan according to the same rules of mitzvot deraita, that women are exempt from positive time-bound mitzvot, mitzvot to seishas man grama. And Hanukkah lights, lichora, seemingly, are the mitzvot to seishas man grama. It's positive, you have to light. It's not a matter of refraining, it's a matter of doing, and it's time-bound. It's a certain time of the year. It's not any time, other time of the year. And therefore, you would think women are exempt from Hanukkah lights. The only reason halakha lemaaseh women are not exempt is because of special reason. Because af hen ayu botonis, even they were part of the miracle, which is two interpretations, but historically, since women were part of Hanukkah, therefore women are obligated in celebrating Hanukkah. But the baseline assumption is they would not be obligated, because just like mitzvot deraita, the women are exempt from positive time bound, so with the rabbanan.
And they're also obligated to listen to the Megillah, the woman.
And same thing with Megillah. Women would be exempt because it's positive time, but there's a special reason that even they were part of that nes, the matter of Esther. She was the main agent of the nes, of the miracle. Okay. The last thing we'll do in this Mishnah before we go into another Mishnah is the last line of it, which had said on the top of page 320, Af al pi shezeh shama vezeh shama zeh kivein libo vezeh lo kivein libo. Even though this one heard and this one heard, this one intended his heart and this one didn't intend his heart. So structurally speaking, what's extremely difficult, perhaps I didn't help you by saying structurally, superficially, what's so hard about it?
You already told it's repetitive.
Right, it's repetitive.
It's repetitive. It seems completely repetitive,
and I have no answer to that. It seems repetitive. I don't know. Let's go on. What we're focusing on today is Mishnah Chet. Uh-oh. Let's see if we can do this in 50 minutes. Mishnah Chet. This is the last Mishnah of the Perek. Okay? I didn't give you a source, Michael?
No, I'm looking at the...
Oh, you're looking... I see. Okay, so this is Mishnah Chet. And it says as follows. V'haya kasher yarim Moshe yado v'gavar Yisrael v'gomer. And it was that when Moshe would lift up his hands, were victorious Yisrael, etc. V'gomer means etc.
V'gomer means they won.
No, v'gomer?
Yeah.
No, gover.
V'gomer.
V'gomer means etc. So this is a quote from Shmot 17. Right? The famous story of Yisrael being attacked by Amalek.
Yeah.
And since we don't have time, we won't open up inside, but we know the story, basically. We were attacked. And Yeshua was sent by Moses to lead an army to fend off the attack. And Moses goes up to the top of the hill, right? And he holds up his hands. And whenever he holds up his hands, the Jewish people are victorious. When he lets them down, we start losing the battle, until you have on each side of him Hor and Aaron, who put a rock and with the rock somehow help him to hold up his hands. That's the story, right? The whole story. And look what the Mishnah says about that. It says as follows, the last two words of the line. V'chi yadav shel Moshe osot milchama o shovrot milchama. V'chi, the word he makes a statement into a question. Is it that the hands of Moshe make the war or break the war? Yeah. This doesn't make any sense. So the answer is Ela Lomar Lachara, to say to you, Kol Zman Shayu Yisrael Mistaklin Klapei Mala Mishabdin Et Libam Laviyam Shebashmayim Hayu Mitkabrim Bimlav Hayu Noflim. Translation, end of the second line, rather to tell you that all the time that Yisrael looked upward
up to heaven
and subjugated their hearts to their Father in heaven, they were victorious. And if not, they fell. That's all it says. Hear that? And then it goes on to say, Kayotse Bedavara Talmer, similar to this thing you say, quote from the book of Numbers, Aselech Hasara Fesimoto Al Nes, make for yourself a copper snake and put it on a pole. Vaya kolin ashuch v'ra'u tovachai, and it will be that anyone who is bitten will see it and live. So that's the story, remember, that the Jewish people were attacked because of their sin by snakes or serpents, and they were dying, and Moses davened, and after the people asked him, and God said, make a copper snake, put it on a pole, and anyone who looks at it will live. And that's what happened. So says the Mishnah, v'chi nachash mimit, o nachash michaye, and could it be that the snake kills, or the snake brings alive? It means the copper snake. Could it be the copper snake
to do with that? No.
Causes people to live or die? Ela bisman shistere Yisrael mistaklin klapei mala shabdin et libam laviyam shebeshamayim hayu mitrapim v'imlav hayu nimokim. Rather, all the while that Yisrael look upward and subjugate their hearts to their Father in heaven, they were healed. And if not, they were diseased. End. The last part of the Mishnah we'll get to in the last 2 minutes of our class, hopefully. We're not going to read it now. It's a completely different subject. Okay, so that's the story. It's very well known. You've heard of it, right? You've heard of it? But it's actually very, very problematic to understand what's going on here. So let's go to the questions. I tried to make questions will help us go stage by stage in this thing. So we're in F1. How is this Mishnah related to what preceded it?
Previous Mishnah we're talking about because of the Kavanah.
Kavanah, right? Right? The previous Mishnah talked about Kavanah, and this one says that all the while that we look up and subjugate our hearts to heaven. Apparently, the subjugate our hearts to heaven is parallel to the Kavanah. Now, by the way, there are different textual variants of this Mishnah that don't say Mishabdim et Libam Leviyam Shemaim, subjugating their hearts to the Father, but rather Michavnim et Libam, focusing their hearts, which would make it really parallel, make it very clear. And like I said, some of the Girsaot, some of the text, use that word specifically, but our text doesn't. But still, I think the connection is clear. Okay? Point number two, question number two. Which interpretation of the halakha in the previous Mishnah does this Agadah seem to support?
So you have to have Kavanah and be focusing on the actual mitzvah.
It would seem, right? Because if the previous Mishnah was only talking about Kavanah to do the act, then it has no relationship at all to anything religious, anything godly, then it's really not connected to this Mishnah. So this is a time to ring the bell and go back to things we've talked about for the past 3 years in this framework, that one of the principles that I always like to harp on and prove is that there is a connection between halakha and agadah. In other words, you could say, and you could make a very good case for it here, that the agadah we read now, which is here embedded in the Mishnah, comes to teach a halachic lesson. That it's saying something about the quality and the depth of the Kavanah we've been discussing in the previous Mishnah. Right? That's important.
Just looking at the copper snake doesn't do the job.
That there has
That's
to be...
That's what this is saying.
Right, right. Very good, right. It's not just a technical act of knowing that you're blowing the shofar, or knowing that you're listening to a Megillah. There has to be some type of religious
concentration,
right? And that's made very clearly, that point is made clearly by this Mishnah. What normative message, I'm in question three, might this Mishnah be teaching over and above the halachic minimum taught in the previous Mishnah? Right? And it's the same thing. Not only do we learn from this Mishnah that the Kavanah discussed in the previous Mishnah was not the Kavanah just to do the act, it was the Kavanah certainly to do the mitzvah, but more than that, this apparently is telling us that don't limit your Kavanah and mitzvot to the technical Kavanah of intending to do the mitzvah, but it's about Mishabdim et libam levim shamayim. It's about intending and focusing and subjugating the heart to our Father in Heaven. Okay. Now to go into the depth of the Mishnah. Question 4. When the Mishnah asks, V'chi yadav shel Moshe v'chulei, and is it that the hands of Moses, etc., what type of explanation or worldview is it rejecting? To actually answer this question with one word, probably. Right. What is the Havamina? How is it that people could have understood the verses in the book of Exodus such that the Mishnah has to correct that interpretation? Oh. One word. It could be one word.
Well,
it doesn't have to
say
be.
One word, you might say magical.
Yeah.
But
right.
Better to me would be that Moses had the power to do something.
Yeah.
By raising his hands, as opposed to God having
right.
being
right.
the source.
That seems to be the issue. That seems to be the issue.
What's the one word you think of?
Huh?
What's the one word you think of?
Magical.
Oh, that's
magical.
Magical. Yeah.
It's
right.
Good. It's good.
But magical is indicative, the word means that physical force and events of independent power taken out of the context of a godly supervised universe. Right? That's what magical means. And could it be that Moses just lifted up his hands and that caused the victory, and putting his hands down that caused the defeat? Right? Unlikely. Unlikely, because this is a religious framework in which we're reading the Torah, and we assume that God is in charge, so why is there no mention of God here? What is it presented as something quite magical or mythical?
Well, we do have magic, don't we?
Ah, yeah?
Right.
Where?
Like in the Pharaohs, they performed magic. They didn't. It was a different type of work. It was indirect.
Okay, but that's a very good point. But you could certainly say that with the signs that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives to Moshe, and then with the plagues, the idea is to show that Paro's magic is nothing at all. And Paro's magic is overruled or overridden or defeated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu's sovereign hand. And if that's the point at the beginning of Shemot, then it wouldn't make sense for later in Shemot for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to destroy everything and show that really Moses is just a magician. But we're wondering why the verses don't mention God. Why they mention under the hands of Moshe.
Yeah.
That's what's bothering us.
So he can be a magician. In other words, could Moses be possibly in this situation, could be a magician.
Yeah. Again, there's no mention of God. It says Moses raises his hand, the people win. No mention of God, of belief, anything. Anyway, so we go now to Mishnah, same Mishnah 5. I put a sheet for Amiram over there. Question 5. According to the Mishnah, now this gets complicated, we have to go into the text. According to the Mishnah, what was the function or purpose of the upraised hands of Moshe? Let's read it again. What was the function of the upraised hands? And it doesn't say it explicitly, it doesn't say. What the Mishnah says is the following. I'm reading the third line of the Mishnah and the fourth line. Kol zman Shayu Yisrael mistaklim klapei mala, all the while that Yisrael were looking upward, umishabdim et libam levim shamayim, and subjugating their hearts to heaven, they would win.
Yeah.
So the explanation here, what was happening, doesn't mention Moses' hands.
Right? No.
The text in the Torah only mentions Moshe, nothing else. And then the explanation, the Mishnah doesn't mention Moses' hands.
They did not look at his hands. They looked to heaven.
So what were hands doing? What's the function of his hands, according to the Mishnah?
They did not look at that. They just When they had a victory, they never looked at Moses' hand.
So then why was he there?
What was he
doing?
He was their agent.
Right. What does that mean?
I thought that the hands remind the soldiers to look to heaven.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a reminder.
But unless they were looking back and seeing...
Something like that, yeah.
Okay, that could be. That could be, right? It doesn't say. But it could be that when they looked up and saw Moses pointing to heaven, right, as it were, then they remembered to look. So you can say, in agent, they looked through his hands, not at his hand, but through his hands to heaven. That seems to be the idea. Okay? That seems to be the idea, though it doesn't say it explicitly. They looked through his hands towards heaven. The hands were a sign, a reminder. Okay, so they looked through his hands. And they were mishabdim et libam levim shashamayim, which means we're saying that the havamina, the original interpretation we had, that it's the hands that are the cause, the direct cause of the victory. No, it's not the hands. The hands are only a sign, they're only a means for something else, which is for kavanah. It's just for focus on God. Okay, now I have a second question. If that's what the function of the hands was, then we move to the next level. So they have kavanah, and they win. And when they lose kavanah, they lose. Why? What's the connection between the kavanah and the victory? What can you garner from the Mishnah? Or just, or between the words of the Mishnah, between the lines, what could it be? What could it mean? Why does kavanah bring about victory? And why does lack of kavanah bring about...
God will help you if you believe in it.
God will help you.
Yeah.
In what fashion?
Victorious. He will make you be victorious if you focus your heart on God. And if you don't, you can't make a go of it.
Yeah.
You can't be successful.
Yeah. I'm going to make a picayune distinction in something David said. And I get this from one of my teachers. I'm not sure I'm convinced myself. But David actually used two different languages to explain, and my teacher, Rav Avi Wolfish, claims that there are two different religious worldviews here. You said that God helps us, then you said God makes us. Two different things. In other words, is all the emphasis on the kavanah and on God such that the victory would be claimed a miracle, would be classified a miracle?
Hello?
That's the makes us. God Hello? Makes us victorious if we have kavanah. Or is it God helps us, which means we have to keep fighting, but our natural efforts are more successful when God helps us. Again, I'm not sure the distinction is so clear. One of my teachers claims it's the fundamental point in the whole Mishnah. I'm not sure. And it's not clear which of the two it is, if there's really a difference between them. Right? It's not clear. Although we'll claim that that distinction will become clear, again, this is from my teacher, when we compare this to another source that words it differently. So let's go on with my questions in the meanwhile, I think. We just did number six. We just did number six. And now we're going to do number seven. Oh, no, I just want to say one other possibility in question number six. So he said one possibility that God makes us victorious when we have kavanah, another that God helps us to become victorious, and another possibility I'd like to mention is that God's not involved at all in any direct sense. But when we have kavanah, meaning when we're certainly convinced of our divine mission, then in a psychological, naturalistic sense, we're more successful. But when we forget what it's all about and lose faith, as it were, then we have no faith in our and ourselves, and we lose. That's a third possibility.
No God in there, right? I mean, or there's multiple gods in there.
Person's own.
Right, so a jihadist is convinced in his mission and he succeeds, or, you know what I mean?
In a psychological sense, that might be true. Hmm. Right. Right? The psychological, and I'd say in a psychological sense it is true. What do you mean? Might be, of course it's true. It's a truism. Mm-hmm. Right? And it could be that the Mishnah is simply telling us that we need to be reminded of our God-given mission. And when we're reminded of our God-given mission, our mission is more successful. And we're not reminded of our God-given mission.
There's no supernatural intervention whatsoever. It's just
psychological. That's my third suggestion. The first suggestion, let's say that's God's doing and making the victory, the war, as a result of Kavanah. The second is God helping the victory. And the third is God's not involved at all in any direct sense. God's involved psychologically, but not directly. And that fits also, right? That fits also. I would even say in a certain sense that's the most probable, because if it meant God, it would have said God. Right? The point is that you would have thought it's all Moshe. Ah, no, it's really God. Then why doesn't it say that? It doesn't say that. What it says is, Mishabdim et libam, that they subjugate their hearts. So I would say the pshat is, when they subjugate their hearts, it's the subjugation of the heart that causes the victory, not God. It's the inner psychological movement towards faith.
Mr. Gabriel.
Okay.
An interesting thing. There's a little, like when you pray, they say when you pray, you ask God to do something, right? So your prayer is going to, maybe you don't deserve it or what. God isn't, you know, you have predestination. Everything's meant to be the way it's meant to be. So why pray?
Yeah.
Right? So, in this case, why pray if you're going to win, it's all predestined whether you're going to lose the war or not.
Yeah.
So there's a little, thing that says, let's say somebody's praying for somebody to get well or something that you want with that, maybe you're not deserving it. So you change, when a person prays, he changes himself. He changes himself.
Right.
Therefore,
right.
He then becomes, like he wasn't worthy before. So in other words, you're changing destiny in a way.
I agree.
So perhaps God, they're praying here and they're showing, that they have a good heart. So God then becomes predisposed in their favor.
Yeah, what Mike is saying indeed is true. Just like in Tefillah, we can say that Tefillah changes God or Tefillah changes you. Same thing here. Is the Kavanah something that affects God or something that affects you? Yeah, that's a good parallel. Okay, so now let's go to question 7. Why is the explanation that the Mishnah provides for the biblical passages considerably less probable vis-a-vis the Nachash than vis-a-vis Yadav Shel Moshe? Remember, the second case is the Nachash, the serpent. So this is really bothersome. We said we have three interpretations of the hands of Moses. Either they bring us to Kavanah, which makes God intervene, or God intervenes to make the war, or God simply helps the war, or it's an inner psychological movement. If you apply those three to the case of the snake, wait a second, then I'm confused. So there's this snake there, and you're going to tell me that when we look at the snake, they remember God? I can understand. Moses, top of the hill, is pointing towards God. Okay. We remember God. And then well, the three possibilities of what that does to us. But with the snake, first I don't understand why looking at a snake reminds you of God. And even if I get over that, I don't understand why now, because I'm reminded of God, no, I take it back. The three possibilities might fit, but I don't understand why looking at the snake reminds me of God. That's the big thing.
That's a weird one.
And that's not clear.
The third is actually hard, because is my confidence in God without God interfering, can that make me well?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. It can make you well from a snake bite? I mean, that doesn't make sense.
There's always the factor of faith, right, in healing. Of faith, of confidence, of optimism.
Sure, but optimism is not going to
cure of a snake bite.
Or a substitute for an antibiotic or an antidote.
Well, they have this group of Christians that they play with the snakes, and they get bitten, and they don't get infected by it.
Sometimes they die.
Sometimes they die, but sometimes they don't. You know what I mean?
Whether or not they have
enough pain. Sometimes they die from the snake bite.
But sometimes they don't.
Okay.
But you know what I mean? And this is a documented, as far as I know, it's a documented fact that these people will handle snakes, and then they'll get, I guess they can get bit by them, and they don't get, or maybe I'm messing up. Maybe they handle them, they don't bite them.
Yeah. No, they handle them and they get bit.
Well, I mean, no, it's not. Maybe
okay. Anyway, we get the point.
They get bit, then they die.
But in any case, this matter of the snake is difficult to understand. Why does licking the snake remind you of God? Can anyone help me with that? I'm serious. I don't understand. Why licking at the snake would remind us of God?
I know it's kind of problematic because later in the prophets, they turn the snake into an idol, right?
Right. Very good. Yeah. So the only thing I can think of is that looking at that copper snake reminds someone that the snakes that bit us were sent by God. I'm not exactly sure why. And then...
There's no explanation.
It's hard.
Or anything like about that?
I didn't look.
There's also, you know...
I don't know. So in the Gemara there's not. In the Rishonim there might be.
It's like the snake with the power. You know, the magicians threw the snake down. Mm-hmm. Maybe had related to that somehow.
They didn't have the right medicine. They just want, the only choice they have is to pray to God to help them out, to save them from the bit of the of the snake. They didn't have the medicine. They prayed to God and God helped them, saved them. That's the way it's said to me.
Yeah. Look, what you can say is that you can say that when they looked at the snake, they knew that God told Moses to make that snake. So they remembered God, but it's rather convoluted. Yeah. It's difficult.
Why didn't God get rid of the snakes?
Why didn't?
God get rid of the snakes.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. Okay, so now I have a number of sources that I prepared. Very interesting sources here. The first source is from the Wisdom of Solomon. And you probably never heard of the Wisdom of Solomon. The Wisdom of Solomon is an apocryphitic book, which means that it's part of that body of literature that was written by Jews, for Jews, and about Jews, after our canon was closed, but in the same style as the canon. In other words, it's not written as a book of Tor Sheba'al Peh, it's not halachically worded, it's not in the same style as Tor Sheba'al Peh, the style of Tor Shebichtav, but it didn't make the grade, at least because it was written too late.
Could be. I heard that. I thought it was also could have been before when they had these books. They had all these books and they wanted to see which one was going to
be. No, this particular one, all of them, all the books of the Apocrypha were written after the year 250 before the Common Era, which is just too late to have made it into the Tanakh.
Yes, there's 250.
After 250 before
the
Covenant.
All the books in the Catholic Bible, right?
So that's what I'm about to get to. That there are about 40 books that we have today in our hands that are from the period of 250 before the Common Era until 200 after the Common Era. There's lots of them. There's about 40. A small number of them have been preserved because they were part of the Roman Catholic Church. They were part of the Bible called the Apocrypha. But there are lots of books that aren't part of the Apocrypha but were preserved by other churches, by the Coptic Church or by the Greek Orthodox Church. They weren't preserved by Jews since they weren't part of the canon. But again, they're Jewish books written by Jews, for Jews, and about Jews, in some cases in Hebrew, some cases in Aramaic, some cases in Greek. But they're Jewish books, which...
Like the
Book of the Maccabees, and the Book of Judith, and the Book of Ben Sirah, and many of them. We have it today?
We have it preserved because
it's not in the Catholic
Church. It's in the Church.
Yeah. So...
Were there any books that were written before that time, within the appropriate time, that weren't included?
In Tanakh?
I think the answer is yes, but I don't know enough about it.
You heard of this, the Lilith?
Say it again?
You ever hear of the Lilith? The story of Lilith?
I've heard of the story.
Is that... You know anything about that?
No.
Women's Lib?
No. We're going to read the Wisdom of Solomon. So what I wrote here that the Chokrim, that the researchers claim that this was written someplace before 200 BCE but after 100 AC. E, which means for us the following, that this book was absolutely positively written before the Mishnah was codified. It doesn't mean it was written before our Mishnah was formulated, but it's before the Mishnah was codified. Right? The Mishnah we learn today might have been a tradition in Torah Shabbat Peh for hundreds of years before it was codified. But it was in this form edited and codified after the wisdom of Solomon. Look what the wisdom of Solomon says.
Is this one of the things in the Christian
Bible? Yes. I got this from... you can get it. I got it from a Christian collection. For when the dire venom of beasts came upon them, and they were dying from the bite of writhing serpents, this is our verse in the book of Numbers, your anger endured not to the end. Speaking to God, God's anger didn't endure. But as a warning, for a short time they were terrorized, and then they received a symbol of deliverance to remind them of the precept of your law. For he who turned toward it was saved, not by what he saw, but by you, the Savior of all. In other words, this source is struggling with the same question, the same difficulty our Mishnah is struggling with, which is, if this looks like magic. It looks like the serpent itself, the copper serpent, is powerful. And the answer is, it's not powerful. It's God who's behind the copper serpent. When you look at the copper serpent, for some reason, it doesn't say why, but for some reason, it's God who saves you, not the copper serpent. Of course, the question is still asked, why does looking at this thing cause God to save you? So I think it's fascinating to see that even outside of Torah Shabbat Peh, I should say it differently, it could be that the wisdom of Solomon is an echo of the same type of issue that is within the Jewish world as the Mishnah is an echo of that. Right? It's about the same time period, and these Jews are struggling with the apparent magical element of Torah. Could it be? The answer is no. It can't be. It has to be understood differently. Okay, so that's fascinating. The next verse is even more fascinating. Justin Martyr, anyone ever heard of Justin Martyr? Justin Martyr is an early, early church father from about the year 150 of the Common Era. From the little I know, he's a rabid anti-Semite and wrote a lot about Judaism, a lot against Judaism. This dialogue with Trypho is a dialogue with a Jew who's trying to convert to proto-Christianity. And we have this today. You can look on the internet and see it. I got it on the internet. And he uses our stories that we're learning today to prove Christianity to this Jew of the second century. And understand that even this source is before the Mishnah. The year 150 of the Common Era is before the Mishnah is codified. So I have to tell you the truth, that I was disgusted when I read this. It's hard for me to read, but I thought it's instructive, so I'll read it. I have an innate just churning of the stomach when I read it. When the people, replied I, wage war with Amalek and the son of Nave, Nun, by name Jesus, Joshua, right? See the connection already there? Right?
Led the fight.
Yeshua is the Jewish general. It's the same name as Jesus. His name was Yeshua. Led the fight. Moses himself prayed to God, stretching out both hands, and Hor with Aaron supported them during the whole day so that they might not hang down when he got wearied. For if he gave up any part of his sign, which was an imitation of the cross, the people were beaten, as is recorded in the writings of Moses. But if he remained in this form, Amalek was proportionally defeated, and he who prevailed by the cross. For it was not because Moses so prayed that the people were stronger, but because while one who bore the name of Jesus was in the forefront of the battle, he himself made the sign of the cross. So I guess that means, it's hard to see who is he, that when Moses made the sign of the cross, right? It doesn't mean he put his hands heavy, he put his hands like this, then Joshua made the sign of the cross, and that's what caused them to be successful in battle. I think, if you think differently, then tell me, and I'm no expert in this, right? For who of you knows not that the prayer of one who accompanies it with lamentation and tears, with the body prostrated, with bended knees, propitiates God most of all, but in such a manner neither he nor anyone while sitting on a stone prayed. I don't understand everything I'm reading. Nor even the stone symbolized Christ as I have shown. So again, what it seems to be saying, from what I understand, is that the sign of the cross is what brought them victory. So why do I bring this here? Just to show how this particular issue of what is the power of the hands was a live issue in three different sources that we read here. I'm sorry, one is the power of the hands, the power of the snake. That matter, there seems to be magic in the Torah, has to be dealt with.
So was it the time? Sorry. Was it the time that, because of the Greek influence of logic and that type of a thing, that made them say this can't be supernatural, we have to figure out another way to explain this? Or is that what you're saying?
That's interesting. I didn't say that.
There's a way of trying to explain this without it being a magic or something.
All I'm saying is that we have this struggle going on. I don't know. We don't know when the struggle began. I don't know that it's a result of any particular historical influence. I just don't know. I'm just saying that it's a live issue in this period. Why in this period, I don't know. And this, when I say this period, it's a long window of time.
The Christian answer seems to be it was magic. The sign of the cross does the job. It seems to be answered exactly opposite from the Mishnah and from the wisdom of Solomon.
Mm-hmm. You know, I guess you're right. I didn't put enough thought into what is the power of the cross according to the source.
Well, what we've read so far.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's see another source and see if it's borne out.
Yeah. I kind of think that it's the... it says propitiates, is it? I don't know exactly what it means, but I thought it means to sort of prompt he's saying that prayer works. Praying, that's my impression. It works in God helping you, but you've got to do it in this particular way.
Well, I thought that is saying... I took that to mean that that's not enough. You have to make the sign of the cross.
Well, okay, but the point is not just it's not a magical sign. It's a way to connect to okay. God. Because he's saying, you know that prayer, it seems to be saying, I think, that, everybody knows that prayer works, but look, they weren't praying, they weren't shuffling, they were doing, making this cross, and that's the way to pray to connect to God, I think.
But the English is actually not clear.
The English is very difficult. It's about prayer and whether it works or not. But it doesn't say whether it does or not. So my interpretation was prayer doesn't work. You had to have made the sign of the cross. That's what counted.
But Amiram's way also works here. Yeah. But it's just praying through the proper power, to the proper power. Okay. Again, I don't know. Section 94. For tell me, was it not God who commanded by Moses that no image or likeness of anything which was in heaven above? I'm just continuing right on. Mm-hmm. 94, where we left off. Right? For tell me, was it not God who commanded by Moses that no image or likeness of anything which was in heaven above or which was on the earth should be made? And yet who caused the brazen serpent to be made by Moses in the wilderness and set it up for a sign by those who bitten by serpents were saved? Yet is he free from unrighteousness? For by this, as I previously marked, he proclaimed the mystery by which he declared that he would break the power of the serpent, which occasioned the transgression of Adam, and would bring to them that believe on him who was foreshadowed by this sign, i.e. him who was to be crucified, salvation from the fangs of the serpent, which are wicked deeds, idolatries, and other unrighteous acts. Unless the matter be so understood, give me a reason why Moses set up the brazen serpent for a sign and bade those that were bitten gaze at it, and the wounded were healed. And this too, when he himself commanded that no likeness of anything whatsoever should be made. I'm trying to understand.
Answering the challenge of the, you know, the Jesus on the cross really isn't all that bad. You're allowed to do things like that.
Oh, that's what you think he's saying?
Yeah, God did say don't make these symbols, but it wasn't meant that way. Because we have the serpent. God said make the serpent, and this is that's.
Wait a second. I didn't think that. Let me think about that.
It says he who was foreshadowed by this sign.
Yeah, right.
So somehow,
although that's put in by the translator, it looks like. But the translator is trying to tell us that it's not like David. It's rather that the reason the copper serpent worked is because it was a sign of the cross. And that teaches you that the cross breaks the power of the original sin in Gan Eden, in the Garden of Eden. Okay, I'll leave that to do at home, but I'll just point out to you that according to this dialogue, this is what converts the Jews. This logic converts the Jews. I don't know.
Was this in Hebrew or in Aramaic? You know?
I assume it's in Greek. I
it
assume
was
it's in Greek.
By Jews, though, right?
Well, we don't
Justin
know.
Meyer wasn't a Jew,
okay.
Right? Well, on this, another of those who came on the second day said, "You have spoken truth." And so the Jews came back and said, "You're right." And that convinces us that we're converting. Let's read the last paragraph. Then I replied, "Just as God commanded the sign to be made by the brazen serpent, and yet he is blameless. Even so, though a curse lies in the law against persons who are crucified, yet no curse lies on the Christ of God, by whom all that have committed things worthy of a curse are saved." Okay, anyway, it's fascinating. Not exactly clear, but it is an effort to, again, deal with the magical issue that comes up here with the serpent and with the hands of Moshe. So what I want to do now at the end, what time is it? Probably, yeah, very good. Going back to the inner workings of the Mishnah, how is it that the looking at the hands of Moses causes the Israelite army to be successful? Is it psychological? Is it that the faith in God gives them inner strength? Or is it quasi-supernatural, in the sense that the faith in God brings God to help them? Or is it overtly supernatural, in the fact that if they look up to heaven and subject their hearts, God does directly make them win, even without any type of human input? Those three levels we talked about earlier, and I want to look at the Michilta, the Midrash on the Book of Shemot, that brings our same verses and our same issue and the same answer almost. V'haya kasher yarim Moshe et yado. You see the source? It's I in the sheet, right?
Yeah, I in the sheet, yeah.
That's the verse. And it was that when Moshe lifted up his hands and was successful Israel.
Yeah.
וכי ידיו של משה מגברות ישראל או ידיו שוברות עמלק. And is it that the hands of Moses strengthen
the Jews.
The Jews, or the hands break
Amalek?
Right, that's the same question our Mishnah said in different language. Right? Remember going back to the Mishnah had said, is it that Moses' hands, do they make the war or break the war?
Yeah.
So this says, do they make victorious Israel, or do they break Amalek? The same thing. Ella, last four words of the line. Ella, kol zman shemagbia yado klapei mala. rather all the while that he lifted his hands upward, and that's what our Mishnah says in different language. I'm sorry, our Mishnah doesn't say that at all. Our Mishnah says, all the while that Yisrael looked up. Our Mishnah leaves out the stage of his hands. Whereas this says, all the while that his hands were lifted up, Hayu Yisrael mistaklin bo. Yisrael was looking at him.
She just looked at Moses' hands.
Moses' hands, right. Umaminim kemi shepakad Moshe lasot kein, and believing in he who commanded Moses to do that.
Yeah.
I'll say it again. That when he lifted up his hands, they looked at his hands.
That God appointed him.
And believed that God appointed him to do that.
To do that, yeah.
The Kodesh Baruch Hu oselehem nisim ugvurot. And God makes for them signs and wonders. Okay? So I just want to point out the differences between the Mishnah and the Midrash. In the Mishnah, it says all the while that the Jews look upward, which seems to mean look up towards heaven, meaning that his hands are a sign that look through his hands to heaven, then they subjugate their hearts and they're victorious. In the Braita, they look at his hands. It doesn't say they look towards heaven.
Yeah,
they look at his hands. And they believe in he who commanded him to do that. Now what does that mean? It doesn't mean that they look at God through his hands. It means something slightly different. It means that they look at his hands doing this crazy thing, and they say, ah, he must be commanded by God to do that. It's not that the hands are direct sign to remind us to look at heaven. It's something much more disjointed. It's something much more... It's because his hands look so crazy that they remember, ah, God must have told him to do that. And that causes them to remember God. And when they remember God, it says God does for them signs and wonders. So I think what's clearly clear is that our Mishnah could have said God did for them signs and wonders, and it doesn't say that. The Mechilta says it. Because remember, in our Mishnah, God is not mentioned. So either you say that the Mishnah holds like the Mechilta, but just doesn't say it, or the opposite. The fact that it uses different language means it has a different philosophy behind it. And that's the direction that my teacher Avi Wolfish was going in, that according to the Mechilta, we're talking about direct divine intervention. Whereas according to the Mishnah, we're talking about one of the two other softer possibilities. It's not direct divine intervention with God doing signs and wonders, God doing the victory. It's about humans doing the victory. It says that they were victorious. It doesn't say in the Mishnah that God intervened. So either the Mishnah is simply the psychological approach, or it's what you can call a soft divine intervention. Right? God helps them help themselves. They still have to keep fighting. It's not that God does signs and wonders. God helps those who help themselves, or the completely psychological way that there's no direct divine intervention at all in any sense. It's simply the power of faith.
Or complete ambiguity, leaving it open because the redactors have multiple views and don't want to take a position.
Okay, but okay, so it's leaving out those words that God does signs and wonders and leaving it open. Yeah, but it's leaving out those words. Let's just see what the Mechilta goes on to do with the matter of the snake. In the last two lines of the Mechilta, it says, "Chayotse bo sham." We find there similarly, V'yom Rashem Moshe, Asela Hasarach, that God said to Moses, make for yourself the copper serpent. And it says, V'chi nachash me'mit u'mechayen, is it that the serpent kills and brings to life? Ela kolzman shayal sekein, hayu Yisrael mistaklin u'maminim b'mishapakad et Moshe lasot. Rather, all the while that he did thus, that he made the snake, Moses made it, Yisrael looked at it and believed in he who commanded Moses to do it. In other words, they looked at the snake and said, wow, that's a crazy thing to do. It must be that God commanded Moses to make the snake. Ah, remember God. the Kodesh Baruch Hu Selem Refuah, and God makes for them Refuah. It says explicitly, God makes for them the Refuah. God makes for them the healing. Which it doesn't say in our Mishnah. It doesn't say in our Mishnah that God made the healing. It just says in our Mishnah that when we looked up and they subjugated the hearts of heaven, that they were healed. It doesn't say who healed them. In the Mechilt, it says that God healed them. So again, there's less an emphasis on God in the fashion we said. Either it means to say that, what does it mean to say? It looks like my interpretation, that they're healed simply through the confidence of their own faith. Now, I admit that's strange to say.
In every war, soldiers will not go forward. I wasn't for so many years. We were not moving forward unless the leader stood up and picks up his hands. And then we go. We follow him. There has to be a leader to pick up his hand and follow him. So maybe that's what the mission means. That Moses picked up his hands and the Jews gained strength, power. The leader is going. So we follow him. We're going to win the war.
Yeah.
That's in every war. That's what happened, because I've been 7 years fighting in World War II, and I'm telling you the truth. There is no other way to get the infantry or the even the artillery to go to move unless the leader stands up and does it in the front. I was the one who used to go first in the front. I was a lieutenant and I was a captain, and I had to go forward all the time.
Wow.
And but it's the same thing is here. Moses was the leader. He was the leader, and the Jews believed in him, and they also believed in God, of course. That's a different story. Moses was the leader, appointed by God.
Yeah. Wow.
Do you think that the tradition continues this ambiguity or lack of clarity in
Polish?
In
I was the been fighting in Polish. Fighting in the Polish
in general.
Against,
well, we could
Nazis
bring in what Michael said earlier
in
about the different theories of tefillah, right?
Right.
It's really the same thing. So I just wanted to close.
Starting from the beginning till the end of the war.
I'm going to say for 2 more minutes. I'm going to talk. Let's now remember this is the end of a chapter, and it ends with Agadah. And the theory we've developed is that the Agadah comes not as something unconnected to the halakha, but comes to explain and deepen the halakha. And we said briefly earlier that earlier the Mishnah talked about kavanah, and here we're talking about a deepening of the kavanah, telling you that it's not enough to have kavanah simply do the mitzvah. There has to be some type of kavanah towards God in a deep sense. And I just want to flesh out how that works. I made a little chart at the very bottom here. It's not my chart. It comes again from one of my teachers. And he says the flow of the Mishnah is as follows. We skip Mishnah 1, which we said was an addendum to the previous chapter, remember? And then we go from Mishnah 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and the flow is like this. It first discusses the animal from which a shofar may be manufactured. That was Mishnah 2 and 3. And then the physical description of the shape of the shofar, remember, bent or straight. And then the sound that emanates from the shofar. And then the hearing of the sound of the shofar, he who hears it. Then the intentionality of he who hears the sound of the shofar. And then, at the end, what we just did is the physical as a tool to connect to God and to thereby affect man's deeds. So what you have is a movement from the outside to the inside. It's the animal that the shofar comes from, and then the shofar itself, and then the sound of the shofar, and then those who hear the shofar, and then the inner intentionality of the shofar. And then the last Mishnah says that you take the shofar, the hands of Moshe, whether it's the sarab, the snake, you take that which is external as a tool to connect to God, and that thereby goes back and affects man's deeds. Right? Because the idea at the end was that somehow this faith, on whatever level you take it, goes and affects what happens in this world. So going from the outer, going inner, you get to the inner, then the inner focuses you towards God, and that connection towards God comes now and shines back onto the physical world. So I guess the ultimate message would be that shofar, in some sense, just like any other mitzvah, it has to be brought from outside to inside, and when it's inside, has to affect you, to connect you to God, and the connection to God has to have some effect on the life that we live. Okay? So our next class will be something like January 15th.